It says up there on the bulletin board that the topic is the Christian and political life, and I want to re-explain what the subtitle is Theses for Reflection and Discussion. And I'm really going to push reflection and discussion. Let me explain what I mean by political life. I don't mean running for Congress or city council. By political life, I mean life in the polis, in the city, in the world. Political life is, as I'm using the term now, it's our life in interaction, in conflict and cooperation with other people beyond the confines of our family. Roughly, now how big is your family? Well, I don't know. That some people have larger families, and I don't mean just that they have more children. By political life, I mean really your life in interaction with those people to whom you would not donate a kidney. There are people in effect with whose welfare you can identify, but only by a considerable effort. Or you may identify momentarily, like you see someone whom you don't even know and they're lying on the pavement bleeding, and there's a real strong identification. You sort of put yourself in their shoes, but you can go away and 15 minutes later you've forgotten about it. You have to work to recall it. All right, and that's, in other words, it's people, I'll put it another way, political life is life among people whom we definitely do not love as we love ourselves. And that you see, that creates a special problem. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't problems in the family. You know, sometimes in the family we can develop relationships of hatred, but I want to stay away from those relationships, because really, as I'm defining political life, we have quite enough. Those relationships of cooperation and conflict, which we work out by really taking into ourselves the well-being of the other person. For example, my 8-year-old daughter, Sarah. Sarah does not have to bribe me or threaten me to get me to be concerned for her welfare and to make some substantial sacrifices. I'll even go into the jacuzzi because she wants me to, and that's a sacrifice for me. I hate to be hot. All right, that's what I mean by political life. So you encounter political life then at work, at Holden Village, in your home congregation, at school. When you watch television, you're involved in political life. Right? In fact, you're involved in it all the time. All right. Now, the Christian and political life, obviously a large topic. And what I am going to do, I said, is I'm going to propose some theses for reflection and discussion. And I want you to think about these theses so that you discover what you believe. What do you think? I believe that most of us don't know what we think about a lot of things. We think we know what we think, but when we're pushed and challenged a little bit, we discover that we hold incompatible views. Well, you can't really hold incompatible views too well. You say, well, gee, I thought that, but I guess I don't think that. You know. And then discussion is no good without reflection. But reflection followed by discussion is very valuable, because in discussion you get a chance to subject your opinions, your views, to criticism. And criticism is very good, because when your views are criticized, then you either change them to make them more adequate, or you hold them more confidently because they have withstood criticism. I think that, I'm not urging you to be dogmatic. I mean, still hold them tentatively. Always remain that the key critic might be just around the corner. But we do have warranted. There are some things that I believe with a great deal of confidence. Ordinary things such as that. I cannot climb Martin Ridge, that the coffee break, that the lunch will be served at 12 o'clock. And the things that I believe with a great deal of confidence are things that have, in effect, withstood criticism. You know, people said, not so. I mean, events, they have just haven't been refuted over and over and over again. And, all right. Now, the procedure is I'm going to state a thesis, I'm going to explain it, I'm going to briefly defend it, and then I'm going to open the floor for discussion. And when the discussion seems to me to have run into diminishing returns, rapidly diminishing returns, then I'll go on to the next thesis. And I have a list of theses that extends all the way back to Chalet 14. I didn't bring them all along, so I hope you better talk, otherwise I have to work from memory. All right, the first thesis, church bodies, and by that I mean congregations or the American Lutheran Church, or of course the Lutheran World Federation, church bodies ought never to take a position on any political question. Now let me explain what I mean by that. By the way, I am not in any of these playing devil's advocate. I have chosen these theses to present to you for reflection and discussion because I think they are good theses. I think it's these recommendations, these oughts in here, I think are, or sometimes they're oughts, sometimes there is. I believe them. They are my views. Examples now, and I said, all right, church bodies ought never to take a position on any political question. Let me give you examples of political questions. Any question that begins with, should we pass a law, is a political question. Now, should we pass a law on gambling? That's a political question. Church bodies ought to take no stand on it. On liquor, on Anita Bryant, on pornography, or try this one out. Church bodies ought to take no position with respect to proposed legislative changes affecting tax exemptions for church property. Abortion. Church bodies ought to take no position on laws governing abortion. Or what is the Christian position with respect to world hunger? That's a political question. I mean, what ought we to do? Church bodies ought to take no position. Is the practice of homosexuality sinful? Now I'm shifting now away from legal. Because remember, I'm not identifying political with legal. Political life is not uniquely associated with government. In fact, I hope that we will all learn to disassociate political life from government. Government has acquired too much monopoly over political life. We must emancipate political life from government. But is the practice of homosexuality sinful? That is a political question, by my definition of political. And church bodies ought to take no position. I hope you see that I am arguing a somewhat unusual thesis here. Now, why? It's basically because large groups of more than three or four, that take a position on a political issue cannot do so in a useful way. Their statements on the issue will do some combination of these undesirable things. One, blur the options. Fuzz up the options. In order to accommodate the differing views of people in the group. It's just hard when you get into a large group to get the group to agree on something clear when you're talking about a complex and controverted issue. Of course, if it's not a complex and controverted, like, should the United States reinstitute the slavery of blacks? I don't think that's a very complex and controverted issue, and I would have no objection if some church body took a position on that in 1978. but what's the use of it? What's the use of taking a position where everybody agrees? But when groups take positions. I think they blur the options in order to accommodate the differing views of the members, and thus they muddle rather than clarify the issues. Secondly, when groups take positions on political issues, they foster dogmatism, because a group cannot engage in dialogue about the position it has taken. The position just sits there like a dead weight. It is used as a club. That's the way they get used. Two people are debating this, and someone says, well, our church body has taken a stand. It has, and he gets it, and he slugs you with it. And the third thing they do, these statements, they encourage what I call righteousness through membership, or non-membership. You know, my church body has taken the stand that, and therefore I am a good guy. I used to go to meetings of the Lutheran Human Relations Association where we would end up passing a whole set of resolutions deploring. And we would deplore all sorts of racist activity. And I enjoy every enthusiasm unanimously. Amazing. We unanimously deplored racist activity everywhere. Why? Because I think we were proclaiming our righteousness. Examples now of statements that do these sorts of things would be, and I can't remember, I read one last, was it the ALC paper on homosexuality, or was it the LCA statement on homosexuality?
There was an ALC one.
Okay, I think it was the ALC one, all right. That one was circulating around, and I think it's a classic example. Read it. It does all the bad things I'm talking about. Okay. Or any of the social encyclicals of the popes. Oh, all right. The floor is open for discussion.
Man, just for clarification, are you you're zapping in particularly on statement positions, but are you including in that also intervention acts or acts of support? For example, it seems to me that that if there's anything that's political, it's the absorption of the Vietnamese, the Southeastern Asian refugees. Into the American culture. It's kind of like paying political debts. We said, all right, we're not going to abandon these people. The United States said so. We're going to bring them over here. Now, their absorption into the American society is going to require a tremendous amount of accommodation on a very personal, human level. My wife happens to work for Lutheran Child and Family Services in Chicago. And they've been asked by the government to cooperate in the relocation of Vietnamese refugees. Now, that can be, you can interpret that on a number of levels. You can say, well, is it a political complicity? Are we agreeing with the United States government in terms of their political debt payment?
Okay, and I think I can answer that quickly.
Or is it,
people and organizations must act. They have no choice. To not act is to act. They will act, and I am not condemning actions. May indeed imply things. They may imply things. They may not imply things that people infer. But churches must act. I have no objection whatsoever to the church being used. For example, I think some care must be used here. I mean, for the pastor to announce from the pulpit a gathering of the church membership for some. Political action can come very close to a statement, but for example, for church members, to use the church roster as a way of gathering names of people who might be willing to make sacrifices to house and resettle Indo-Chinese refugees is fine. That doesn't anyway fall under what I'm talking about. I am talking about statements. Very specifically, I'm talking about statements where it's time that we issue a statement on this issue, and it comes out in words. Now, that's something you can't avoid. You can't avoid action, but you can avoid a statement. All right? Yep.
What kind of groups should be making these statements? Then? Political parties or labor unions or PTA?
My belief is that no group ought to make such statements. No group at all. You see, you may recall my argument had nothing to do with
the newspapers.
A newspaper isn't a group. my argument was not directed, did not stem out of the nature of the church. It stemmed out of the nature of groups. So I think labor unions, corporations, any group that makes a statement. Now, sometimes a statement will in fact be made by an individual, and like a newspaper. A newspaper editorial is written by an individual, and it represents the viewpoint of that individual. Now, he's usually an individual whom the publisher has given freedom on the condition that he adheres to certain guidelines. Sometimes the publisher will enter in and censor. But that doesn't fall under my condemnation.
How about policy?
Well, a group can have procedures by which the members agree to be bound. Well, sometimes you try to anticipate procedures with a policy statement, and if those are directed toward action, I would have no objection to it.
For example, a corporation might have a policy that they will not discriminate in hiring practices.
That's fine.
Or in promotion or something like this. You're not.
Those are guidelines for the action of the corporation.
No.
Yeah, that's to control our own behavior, and that's fine. You see,
a church cannot have that kind of a policy.
Oh no! If it's designed to control the behavior of the members of the congregation, that's okay. Like, we will not come in late to the church service. We will remain in the narthex until. You know, that would be a policy. Whatever you would, but it's designed.
So I mean a policy on more of a political issue.
Well, could you give me an example?
A policy having to do with church will not discriminate against members of this maybe.
No, you see, okay, but all right, but see, that's a policy designed to govern the action of the members of the organization. And I don't call that a statement. I mean, you've been quote worth, but I'm not including that in your statement.
Yeah.
A statement is something that is published, that goes out to tell others. That's what I mean by a statement. It's a statement. Yeah. Oh, Larry?
Larry, you wanted these for reflection and discussion, and I just wanted to state some objections to the thesis as stated. You're saying, in effect, groups ought never to take a position on any political question. I have some problems at the point of distinguishing so sharply between a position statement and an action. I don't think the distinction between words and act is that clean. A statement, a verbal statement, is oftentimes a part of an action, or is an action, because it has consequences. Now, so I have a little problem with distinguishing so sharply between what we say and what we do. What we say is a part of doing. But I have more problems with the word never. I was interested in the example of slavery. The church ought never, in this case, to take a slave. You said it would be foolish in 1978 to talk about re-enslavement of blacks, but your thesis says also that it would have been wrong in 1858 or 1868 for any group to make a statement about the re-enslavement, in one case the continued enslavement, or 1868 the re-enslavement of blacks. Likewise, it's wrong for us now to state anything about Idi Amin's treatment of Ugandans.
You be careful. Don't say it's wrong for us. You may do so, and you may gather
groups.
Friends
I'm
who want
about
to.
Groups.
So, yeah.
That was
okay.
Your word.
Yeah.
And the problem is the word never there. When you listed your objections, it blurs the option that fostered dogmatism of righteousness through membership. Seems to me those are sometimes these things happen. Often these things happen. And then you went from the sometimes and the often to draw a conclusion the phrase as never. You can go back through and you can say, sometimes statements don't blur the option, they clarify them.
Can you give me an example of one statement that has managed to do that, that has been published by a group on a controverted political issue? I've never found one.
I have. Now, are you talking about clarifying the options for whom? I just read the Presbyterian statement, which is a very controversial statement on a very controversial issue on homosexuality. I found it very clarifying of the discussion of homosexuality. And, you know, I mean, it was, for me, a clarifying of positions and options. For someone else, it may have been a blurring of it, that the statement was clarifying. It was, when used in a class, they found that statement very clarifying of schools of thought and of possible policies for the church.
Larry, can I clarify?
The statements weren't so much fostering dogmatism as breaking open some dogmatism that was there. It was a loosening up. So it wasn't always a blurring of option. It wasn't always fostering dogmatism. It wasn't always a heightening of righteousness through membership. Rather, it had different effects in different times on different people. And therefore, I'm hesitant to draw the conclusion of never from a list of some time.
Okay.
The options weren't more blurred
after
the statement than they were before. They were less blurred.
Look, every statement, I guess, is ultimately written by an individual. At least somebody finally types it.
That's different from...
Yeah, and sometimes a statement will purport to be to speak for a body, when in fact it speaks for one or two or three or maybe four individuals who really wrote it. And I think statements written by groups up to about four have a chance of being clear. But when sometimes a statement written by an individual or two really clarified the issue. See, I'm not saying statements can't clarify issues. What I'm suggesting is that statements that are supposed to give the position of this body are, okay, awfully unlikely to do so. And insofar as they do so, I haven't read the Presbyterian statement of which you're speaking, I strongly suspect it wouldn't be accepted by a majority of Presbyterians.
Well, that's all may well be the case, but your statement of your thesis is a much more dogmatic and thorough statement than that. It says groups ought never to take a position on any political question.
Okay, but then you would say suppose the Presbyterian denomination has not approved this statement.
Yeah.
Then is it a statement of that group? I think we're close to getting into a semantic quarrel here. Now,
I would cite Pope John's encyclical Pacem in Terris as a statement. You said no papal encyclical.
Well,
I would say Pope John's encyclical Pacem in Terris was something that didn't blur the options, didn't foster dogmatism, didn't promote righteousness through membership, didn't fall under the things that often happen with statements. On the contrary, it was one which in the course of human events was very helpful to all kinds of people, and I want to find space in the thesis for such as that. That's all. I don't think that's a semantic difference. I think it's a genuine difference.
All right, okay. I don't hold that high opinion of it, and I included papal encyclicals because of my belief, subject to reputation, that papal encyclicals are written by committees. Now, Pope John would definitely exercise a formative influence there, but papal encyclicals that I have read, and I haven't read that many, but I've read social encyclicals, really read as if they've been read by committees, and I have found them most unhelpful. I've engaged in a good deal of dialogue with Roman Catholics about social issues, and I found that the encyclicals are just problems. They've got it. You got to get around the encyclical in order to get to the issues. But we may have had different experiences. You may find things illuminating that I don't find illuminating. Sometimes I claim to find something illuminating when what I have found is somebody who has said what I think in a forceful way. And it really isn't illuminating. What it is supporting. I found in a lie. Larry, I very much value clarifying statements. And if there's any way to get clarifying statements written and read and thought about, I'm for it. I think on that you and I are agreed, aren't we?
Yes, except that you're...
Okay, but now let me finish.
No.
I'm trying to present... all statements containing the word never are false.
Okay, then we don't have a problem.
All right. What I'm trying to do is shift the burden of proof, because I think today organizations, church bodies, are leaping into pronouncements. And I'll tell you the one place where I have trouble with my thesis is the confessing church in Germany. And I've thought about that one a good bit, see if that isn't a counterexample. And that's troublesome.
The confessing church never got around to use that as an example.
Well,
the church has to have made an open statement about the Jews in Germany.
All right, yeah, that's the one that I wonder about. I do think this, that it is possible. Well, I don't want to be too... I want to pull back. Have we achieved some... I'm backing off the never about that much.
And I agree with you that we leak too easily in the statements, most of which are bad. That's a different thing than the thesis are.
Well, very close. Yeah.
Don't you think the church has a responsibility to bring to the attention of its members the issues of the day and present both sides of the argument? So that the members themselves can reach conclusions and take whatever actions they want. The problems with most of the statements is the conclusion, not the premises that are presented. And most of the statements I've read indicate there's probably 10 pages of supporting documentation and one page of conclusion. It's the conclusion that violates the position of the members of the church.
Mm-hmm.
It's the conclusion that is muddled because it's trying to take in too much. But yeah. I do think the church has a responsibility to bring to the attention of its members the problems of the day and suggest that they should come to some conclusion themselves.
Well, I think one could question that, whether that is the obligation of the church to bring to the attention of its members the issues of the day. He who selects the issues, in part, selects the answers. I have been occasionally attending a Methodist church near my house where they just announce certain events, like there will be a rally for gay rights. Now you can choose whether you want to go or not. We're not recommending it. but they don't announce the rally for Initiative 13. Somebody's trying to get a petition going now to reverse Seattle's ordinance.
Somebody else might announce that, so it seems like...
Well, but it doesn't. The point is it doesn't get announced. Now, it's the church...
through some other...
Yeah, but the thing is that if a church... I'm very concerned about churches assuming an obligation to educate their members in the political issues of the day. I'm deeply concerned about it. It has not been my experience that the churches do that well. And I strongly suspect that a church which gets itself involved in that is a church which has lost sight of any mission and is desperately grasping for a mission and does a bad job of educating its members in the issues of the day. In fact, and I'm really getting ahead into some other theses here. But
could I ask just a partial theological question? Do you see that the church can be prophetic in society for also its members without making such statements?
I wonder if we could defer that question, because I want to make another statement. The next thesis is going to be, no Christian should preface a statement with, "Thus saith the Lord." And that's going to, can I defer? Julie?
Well, I plan to make a light statement, but I won't do that.
All right, good.
I have a lot of difficulty with your statement about our church, about the Methodists announcing the gay rights, and that they should announce Anita Bryant.
No, I didn't say that.
As an example that the both sides don't get, just by making the announcement, you select the answer. And I think that, in fact, there really is a right answer on some of these questions, number one. Number two, what comes to mind is the church in the South, both the white and black institutional church. I think when the black church became heavily involved in the political civil rights struggle, particularly in the 50s, where it became a bastion for gathering and so forth and so on, that was appropriate, highly appropriate action for the church. And I wish that the white Southern, particularly Baptist church, which was very strong in the Deep South, I think had that church as an institution taken a position against the kind of legal discrimination and so forth that went on, that could have had an easing effect on that situation. And it did, yeah. In fact, it acquiesced by doing nothing.
Okay, and I made two points. The first, as you know, I also agree there is a right and a wrong on these issues.
I know, I wanted you to say that.
Yes. All of these issues, all political issues are ethical issues. And I do not believe, and I believe that there is right or wrong, and it's absolute. But we don't know what it is, and that's the problem.
How can we not know what it is?
How can we not know what it is? Well,
when somebody's bashing somebody's head in,
well, he may be bashing somebody's head in to prevent that guy from bashing two other people's heads in. You can be extremely confident, but your confidence should be somewhat less than 1.0. That's all I'm saying. No. In order to act, you have to have some confidence. And I'm not saying let's all sit around and waver indefinitely. We must act, but we act on the basis of what we believe to be right or wrong. And we have to have the courage to act, but we do. All right, that's getting into the next proposition.
But then doesn't the church write its theology?
So what conclusion do you draw from that about statements by churches?
Yours.
Well, one can wish that churches were different, but let's. It's always important to begin with the world as it is and not as we wished it would be. I mean, you could construct suppose that in the world people were this way and churches were this way, and well, then I'd draw different conclusions. But given people as they are and organizations as they are and the present state of social organization, I come to these conclusions.
What is the responsibility of the parish pastor then to say to, even though you may disagree with the idea that, say, the church makes a statement on race or the church makes a statement on something, isn't the pastor almost always on the horns of the dilemma? Because if he goes to the pulpit interpreting the New Testament the way most social activists would interpret it, he's going to go against the grain of most congregations.
Mm-hmm.
If he goes along with the status quo and doesn't leap into the arena and preach, say, a liberation kind of a gospel that Jesus was telling the people of his day, then how does he live himself? How do you get everything to think together?
Well, that's getting, you're talking about a pastor, and that's an individual. and I want to come to that.
I'm seeing pastor though as the leader of the county.
Well, fine, so do I. Although I think pastors ought not to be quite as much the leaders of the congregation as maybe they've been. But anyway, that's getting ahead. The pastor is not an organization. He may be the leader of the organization, but he's an individual. Or she's an individual leader.
The pastor claims the gospel from the pulpit. He's not speaking as an individual.
Well, that's getting ahead. Can I? Now, look, I'd like to move on, because I think, and believe me again, I know that I am an authoritarian personality. But I'm going to push us on. And I hope some of you feel dissatisfied. And I want opposing views to be heard, but I don't want views that are opposing future theses to be heard at this time. I want them here. Okay. And then clearly, I mean, what you can all do after here, go to lunch and denounce me. That's all right. Next proposition. No Christian should say, "Thus saith the Lord," when engaging in the critical analysis of political life, because it's presumptuous to do so, and it inhibits criticism. When you say, "Thus saith the Lord," you're saying, "Don't you argue with me, thus saith the Lord." Now, I know against this, you can set the example of certain Old Testament prophets. I don't find the example of the Old Testament prophets persuasive. I don't believe that any of those prophets gained a hearing by starting off with, "Thus saith the Lord." I think there's some evidence that they alienated their hearers. And also, some who said, "Thus saith the Lord," some Old Testament prophets who said, "Thus saith the Lord," were liars. Check Jeremiah. Now, what happened is that some of them who said, "Thus saith the Lord," made it into the canon, and therefore they are the ones who judge which ones were lying. But, you know, either Jeremiah was a false prophet, or some of those other guys were false prophets, some of his contemporaries. I may be getting myself in all sorts of trouble here, but I've noticed that Anita Bryant prefaces a lot of statements with, "Thus saith the Lord." And I don't believe the Lord saith what she saith, he saith. Now, let's just look at this for a moment. Now, if someone here may agree with Anita Bryant, and I'm sorry I've chosen that example. That if you agree with Anita Bryant, just think of some other example that offends you. her claim to have the mind of God carries no weight except with those who already agree with her. I think, making an empirical statement. I don't think that her claim, that no one said, there's nobody who says, "Gee, I didn't agree with Anita Bryant until I realized she's speaking for the Lord. Well, I better change my thinking." It seals her own mind. I mean, that repeating that can, you know, helps her to insulate herself from effective criticism. It conceals an amount of fallible human political analysis, a considerable amount of fallible human political analysis in her position. In which she slides. I mean, just suppose that for a moment that we can take her quoting of the Bible as speaking for the Lord. Just for a moment, say whenever she just quotes the Bible, the King James Version, explicitly, that is the word of the Lord. I'm just assuming that. But she thinks she's drawing inferences from that that I think contain a good deal of empirical sand and gravel along with them, much of which I would question. And it's awfully hard to draw a pure inference. And even if the Lord did speak to you last night in a vision and says to you, "Now go out and interpret this unto my people," in the process of interpreting it, you are going to introduce a lot of potentially fallible political analysis. Okay. Now, The Christian's claim, I think, ought to be, this I sincerely believe to be the case. You're the only authority your statement has is your own conviction. I mean, your sincerity, that you're really saying, you really mean it. And now, but it can be criticized by pointing to the evidence, by logic. I would want to add to this that all concrete political or ethical judgments are based in part upon political analysis. I can't think of any counterexamples. So it follows, and what I said to me, no one should say, thus saith the Lord, when engaging in the critical analysis of political life. And I don't think you can make any concrete statement of any significance about political life without engaging in political analysis. Therefore, no concrete statements about political life should be preceded by, thus saith the Lord. There's problems with that. And you've been pointing them out.
That's the tendency, isn't it, though? Because look at the Dutch church in South Africa. They how do you stop something like that? Or Pittsburgh didn't say, doesn't that people are oppressed because it's right here in God's Word that they've got this mark on them, and so therefore they don't? Or
I don't know how to stop them, but I wish they wouldn't do it, and I'm saying they shouldn't do it.
But I guess I want to put you on the spot, and I see the problem, but I'm not hearing. I know the problem.
You don't hear the solution.
What I'd like to see is some way to handle it, to get a hold of it somehow. And I guess that's why I can kind of.
What's the problem you see in that?
I guess I'm disturbed by the way the church is interpreting the gospel, and I'm disturbed by the way our church stands so vehemently upon the status quo of the way we interpret the gospel. I'm disturbed by the fact that pastors will sometimes lose their congregations because they dare to make a stand upon some important political issue in our lives, because congregations cannot go along with that. So I guess the big question is, how do we speak to one another to help one another to open ourselves to responsibility?
Okay, I think that your concern is not my concern.
Okay.
At the end, the question you asked at the end is a concern of mine. But if a pastor alienates his congregation and gets kicked out of his church because he's taken a stand on a political issue, I am not. I'm not likely to be. I mean, in the pulpit, if he's done that in the pulpit, I am not likely to be disturbed about that. If he loses his pulpit, is kicked out because he has acted, then I am going to be disturbed. Because now this leads to the question: how do we address one another? I think we must address one another confessionally. This is the part of this whole problem which I've been thinking about intensely for a while that disturbs me most. And it was the question. In fact, a guy asked me the question last year up here: how does a pastor preach in a way that grabs the hearts of his hearers? You can't do it, he said, without engaging in political analysis, social and political analysis. In other words, you have to lay bare their situation. Now remember again what I mean by political analysis. You have to understand the structure and interactions of people's lives. There has to be a diagnosis before there can be any prescription. There has to be a question before there can be an answer. There has to be the proclamation of the law before there can be the hearing of the gospel. And I believe now that the preaching of the law, if I can call it that, must always be confessional. It must be the preaching of the law by one who is confessing his own sin and is clearly doing that at the time that he is preaching. Thus, I am debarred from preaching against other people's sins. Now you say, my goodness, does that mean, somebody asked, was that you, Wayne, asking that? Well, then, does that mean you have to commit adultery before you can preach against it? No. What it means is that, first of all, it means don't preach against adultery. Be very, the pulpit is not the effective place, I believe, to do most of this. In the pulpit, you're almost compelled to be too general. You can't really deal with those specific situations. You know, if you get up there in the pulpit and preach against adultery, every member of the congregation who is committing adultery at that moment is going to discover that your sermon doesn't quite fit his circumstances. The indictments I believe that there are two ways to convict the conscience of people. One is, I mean, if you're trying to convict the conscience of a large group of people, you must identify with them. And they must see that you identify with them. If they see you as standing up there and telling them, they are going to turn you off. They are not going to listen with that attentiveness, with that self-examination that is essential to conviction. No one is convicted of sin unless he is self-convicted, unless he participates in that conviction. That is just sort of a psychological proposition. So when you're talking to a large group of people, you've got to enlist their cooperation in their self-conviction, and you won't do that unless you can identify with them. Now, that is difficult sometimes, but well, I don't think it's all that difficult. It certainly excludes any sermons that grow out of anger. If it comes to your attention that there's a good deal of horsing around with other person's spouses in your congregation and you feel you ought to address that, I still would doubt that the pulpit is ever the place to address that, but you would have to talk about find how this culture and this society is affecting you, how you yourself are tempted, how you're drawn. Now, I don't want any cheap statements like, I've been looking at women to lust at them all my life, because that's a sort of a subtle way of saying, but I stopped there, damn it. The other way, of course, the other way is one-on-one, where your empathy just becomes clear in your engagement with that individual, and you can so understand the situation that you can enter into it and help that individual to convict himself or herself. Now, what I've just said, I think, really excludes most of what is called preaching on social issues.
Then if the problem, say, that we see in our congregation is not an overt act, but just simply indifference, where do we go with that?
Well, let me ask you, if the people are indifferent, let's say, are indifferent to the, let's take...
There's no problem.
Well,
I don't see a problem. Why are you telling me?
Well, but I think one should be very careful about what the problem is. Satisfaction is no sin.
But when it's grounded upon fallacy, it is.
Yes. And then your job is to point out to the person the dangerous course on which he's embarked, that he is resting on something that is going to give way. And that can be done sympathetically. That can be done out of love for that individual. If I see you sitting on a rock that is being eroded by Railroad Creek, I can tell you to get off of there without feeling superior. And that's what I just don't believe there's any effective preaching that comes from a person who is seen as superior. And of course, any kind of complex political analysis is going to either force you to be fuzzy or tell you to take positions without adequate argument that are going to alienate and make you look morally superior to a lot of people in the congregation. There's a great deal of preaching on the economy by pastors that is abominable. It is of Satan himself. It turns off every business executive in the congregation who knows. Yeah. No, that's Satan, maybe. No, my authority for this is simply my own sincere conviction. I've listened and I've talked to a lot of business executives. They're a business executive of a very large corporation in Seattle told me recently that he can't stand clergymen any longer, and he's a highly moral man and exemplar of an ethical businessman. He can't stand clergymen anymore, he says. Just a second. Harold.
I was just going to ask for clarification of your thesis. As I understood it, it meant to apply to more than just preaching situations. It says no Christian should confess statements with us. Then what confused me a little bit was the example of the need of iron, which we talked about, I think, just for the answer. And my question is this, is it permissible to cite statements from the Bible or doctrine statements and then use those as premises in an argument and draw an inference from those, which has to do with political situations, provided you don't say that the conclusion is the word of the Lord, but freely admit this is my interpretation of these premises, which I do believe have divine revelation, or you want to rule out the use of thus said the Lord type premises.
Okay. I want to rule out the use of thus saith the Lord conclusions. It's okay to say thus saith the Lord, but I was talking about thus saith the Lord about concrete political questions, all right?
Yeah, but I mean, the selection of the statement has a premise and an argument, of course.
Yeah, okay. You can do a lot of things, I think, when you are engaging in an argument that you cannot do when you are proclaiming. Preaching is a one-way street, however sensitively it's done. There is no opportunity for response. Almost, any argument is okay when I'm just arguing with you. Because if I cheat, you can call me to account right there. And in one of the things that my theses, one of the things my theses are designed to promote is dialogue among people. So if there's opportunity for dialogue, a lot of things, I'll permit a lot of things that I won't permit from the pulpit or from the lectern or from when there's a one-way speaking situation. So I don't think I'm answering your question.
Well, you are. I think that I would maybe make a further distinction and say it's different if it's being spoken from the pulpit than if it's being spoken from a lecture platform.
Well, of course, I'm saying with Christian. If I stand up as a Christian and say, "Now I'm a Christian," and speaking as a Christian, I say this, then there is a distinction then between the lecture platform and the pulpit. But to me, the important distinction is whether there is ample opportunity, and there's never ample. But how ample is the opportunity for response, for criticism, for those who disagree to say, "I think you're mistaken here." See, what's offensive to so many business executives about preachers preaching on economic issues and business ethics is that the preacher gets away with five or six statements that the businessman believes to be simply gross distortions of reality, and he has no opportunity even to point out to the people out there that this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Now, if there is that opportunity, if there's ample opportunity for you to stop me, or and at least say there's question about that. That's really debatable. Then lots more is, you know, a lot more dogmatism, a lot more positive tone is possible. See, if I'm just right now, I'm using a very positive tone, maybe a little, probably a little too positive and assured for this large group. But it's okay. I think when you and I are talking, I can yell at you. When I'm talking to three or four people, I ought not to yell. And when I'm talking to a congregation, then definitely yelling is out of place. Larry, and then I don't know who was
that
next.
Was essentially my,
okay.
My question.
I don't know who was next, whether it was Jim or Jim. You're both Jim, aren't you? Yeah.
I had one chance.
Okay, I just wanted to say, would the reverse be true then, Paul? Could you say that the economic professor should not be speaking of religion to his group, his class, say, in a university situation? See? I mean, it would be inappropriate in so many words.
I think generally it would be inappropriate.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So why should the clergyman have any more option to speak to his group?
I don't like the. It seems to me, I'd have to think about it, Jim. But it seems to me there's not a parallel there. I would have to think why. I certainly agree with you that I ought not to lecture my students on the Trinity, and I teach economics. But I don't think it's the same for the same reason. Yeah, I'm certain it's not for the same reason. But I want to think about why it's different. For one thing, I'd get fired. That's
the students can talk back and answer.
Not in my classroom. I teach 700 students at a time, and there are no questions allowed. Oh, but one, I think, Jim, one reason, I really believe that a preacher or an ethicist or a Christian trying to address the problems of his world has a larger response. The whole world is his oyster. And anything goes. I mean, any amount of evidence. I mean, there really is a sense which the economist is a narrower person. I really believe that nothing is out of bounds. No subject is out of bounds for the Christian or even for the preacher in the pulpit. And I'm not trying to declare things out of bounds. I'm really trying to declare ways of dealing with things out of bounds. And what that tends to lead to is certain rules for verboten topics. I mean, some things you don't talk about from the pulpit, like adultery. I just don't think you ought to talk about it. I don't think you ought to talk about... good example. Now, these are judgment calls, but if you see the principle that I'm trying to work with, I think you can understand. I think that one could legitimately talk about school desegregation from the pulpit, but not homosexuality. Why? Because all of your people are likely to be involved, and you too, in the same way in the problems of forced busing. And you can. The opportunity here for you to really identify and talk about your own feelings and fears and hopes and the courage that you have, and the relationship of the gospel to your courage to act, you can do that in a way that I don't think you just couldn't do to deal with homosexuality from the pulpit. So sermons on gay rights initiatives probably should to just are out of bounds. Well, again, this is all illustrative. This is designed to make you think about these things so that when you get back home, you can provide dogmatic solutions to this. Can I? Jim, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
When you say the statement, thus saith the Lord, you're objecting to that because it's making objective something that's subjective. Is that correct?
No. I'm sure glad you asked that.
Okay.
You see,
faith statements are subjective statements, and you said that earlier, I believe.
No.
No, you didn't say that.
No, all statements are subjective. You're having an argument, and somebody invokes Hegel. Oh no, or Marx. That's very popular. I you say you're dealing with the question, is there a growing concentration of power in corporations? And you're trying to debate, and you're trying to present evidence, and someone says, Marx said, and then delays, that's thus the Lord. That's not analogous. But the point is, it's attempting to answer a question by an appeal to an authority in a situation. It's not enough, because you can probably prove that Marx said it. It's begging the epistemological problem. I'm not saying the Lord don't say some things. I'm saying that we got to be very, very careful in being sure that we've heard what he said. And we ought to be so careful that although we must act and therefore must have the courage of our convictions, that we are acting as he calls us. I very much agree with the statement at the beginning of Douglas John Hall's book that we are called to transform the political life. I believe that. But we must be very attentive. And when we think we have heard the Lord speak, that's sort of our secret. It is revealed in our action, in our courageous action, that we think we have heard the Lord speak. It doesn't come out of our mouths. We take risks and pay costs ourselves, and that's the evidence that the Lord has spoken.
An interesting statement about how the objective word is there, but a part of the humiliation of the cross is that the objective word of God was released into the world to be messed up by all of us. It became subjective in the world, the objective word did. And that is a part of the humiliation of Jesus, is that the word gets misunderstood and wrong conclusions are applied and all of that. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, if you're saying that there's lots of error floating around.
You know, it brings to mind the whole question of the literal translation of the Bible versus the various types of interpretations. And you almost think in terms of the Word of God being literal, thus saith the Lord. But I always have a problem with that if I take it too literal, because it's more or less what the Lord is saying to you as an individual rather than as your group statement, as we were talking about before. Even the Bible is a group statement. People have problems with it. Just existing with that kind of a thing. If it says, thus saith the Lord, here's a literal interpretation of the Bible as a group statement for even a body of people who have a common belief, such as Lutherans. What is that common belief? Well, the Bible is the closest we can come to it, maybe.
For precisely the reason.
People, it's different.
Different. That's things. Right. We Lutherans can all agree on the Bible is because we don't read it.
One test that I've found very useful is that the Bible tells me what I should do. It does not tell me how you should do.
I like that statement. It expresses something that I'm
very... It tests, how... Then it might tell me how I should approach the other person, but it does not tell me exactly how they should act.
Would you just say something about the use of the pulpit for collective function?
Well, I don't know. My next thesis was notions of collective guilt, but that isn't what you had in mind.
Well, I think it's related, whether it's right or wrong, that it's just that.
Is there
a positive collective function? So far, what I'm grabbing from you is that perhaps what we should do is just take the pulpit out of the church altogether.
No, I don't want to do that. I've got to leave you with something that brings you back on Saturday morning, and maybe
Could you just tell those of us who want to hear something?
Yeah.
And the rest of them?
Yeah. I'll tell you this, that I have wrestled for a long time with the function of the pulpit, not too long. 10 years ago, I preached with good conscience. You know, and of course, I read all these statements and found about, you know, fear and trembling every time I enter the pulpit. You know, but I did it because I knew I was good. It's only been in the last, it's been growing. I can't see how far it is. It's growing. It's become intense now, concern when I preach, so that I almost can't do it. And it's because, it's because I believe that I have heard something that's tremendously important to communicate, and that I am almost certain to be misunderstood. And in what way? In a very bad way. That I'm almost certain to give comfort to those to whom I did not intend to give comfort, and to burden those whom I did not intend to burden. That, as I think about that, it makes me increasingly uneasy about the pulpit. And yet, the answer is not to get together and somebody say, okay, now you read the lessons and then you have a group discussion. The problem with that is that not as much gets said. People don't prepare adequately. They really don't think before they talk. But other than that, you know, there is something. I kind of like that idea. And one of the things that many people use, it's been used up here, and I got the impression that John Schramm is going to use it, going to have a Bible study for the texts, but that the preacher will, some of the members of the congregation are invited early in the week to come and discuss the text, discuss the lessons, so that, you know, there's much less danger of being misunderstood, and much less danger of going on an ego trip. And much less, I believe the pulpit is the place of proclamation, but it is the place, it ought to be the place of the congregation's proclamation. There ought not to be a der Herr Pastor up there. And pulpits ought to be low down. And
One way to specify that, Paul, might be to go back to your statement that almost every subject can be discussed from the pulpit, but not necessarily by the pastor. The community has within it varying levels of competency and expertise. And the pastor may be one of the more incompetent members of the community on many of the subjects in which he speaks. That, however, has within it the problem that the person who then speaks from the pulpit speaks both as an expert, for example, in economics, and as a representative of the community. It becomes awfully difficult to distinguish the two. So, for example, Christian ethicists, people who are both skilled in questions of ethics, or in this case, economics, speak with a kind of twofold authority that makes it doubly difficult to disagree with them.
Yes. Yeah.
So it might be that it would be useful to begin to specify in what areas the congregation or the Christian community recognizes certain of its members as being competent to help them analyze the issues, the way
those things. It would help too, Bob. I think if now, you know, for example, there's considerable concern about, well, take abortion, which is a deeply troubling issue, and it's certainly one that Christians ought to be talking about. And I remind you that I said later, it's one on which church bodies ought to make no statements. But certainly Christians ought to be discussing that with one another, and here you could bring in a physician or a nurse or anyone who's really studied it and invite them to raise questions. That's the thing, to raise questions. Tell us what you have seen that we might not have seen. That's I have noticed something this, I've noticed that. And there isn't enough, there's some experts have this ability, you know, to get up there, and they've seen that it just ain't that simple. And they start raising questions about, then maybe a few other people are allowed to speak, and then there's prayer, maybe a word from the pastor of courage, of grounds for hope in the midst of this uncertainty and these agonizing questions, and you go on to the Eucharist. Now that...
Well, you know, when Jesus was at the, did some preaching, he also did teaching from the pulpit, or from the, with, I kind of get the feeling that maybe there could be some teaching of God's Word done at the pulpit. At least if we take some example. Another thing that occurs to me that could be done from the pulpit is to try and, like you say, answer questions and also, or raise questions, I should say, and also try to maybe foster an open mind for people to hear what they can hear themselves. To bring people away from the extreme right and left, but into some kind of a center ground that they, or I don't necessarily mean conservatism, but at least if you start to become too dogmatic, at least have an open mind to listen to the other side of the story. Those are some of the kinds of things that occur to me that could be done.
To go along with that, as an example, our church has hired the pastor that we have has a few of the regular pastoral functions, but his main function is adult education. And he has started groups with different congregations, of which I'm one of them, in one of them, to do reading and theology and things like that. And it's amazing the growth and the attitude change and the just studying the scriptures, not even talking about social change or anything else, but it opens up the flexibility of the scriptures in a way. It also takes away the dogmatism because you see so many approaches to various books of the Bible and how they are written and the questions that are raised. I go along with the education and teaching, both from the pulpit and within the churches, as a method of getting away from the dogmatism and the proclamations that have traditionally come from our next to God preachers.
It's 12 o'clock, and it's, I don't know whether some of you want to catch the 12 o'clock lunch, but if you do, you ought to move in that direction. And if I'm not going to 12 o'clock lunch, am I, Julie? All right. So if somebody doesn't want to go to 12 o'clock lunch and wants to stay here.
Paul, can I just point out something unless some other hand was up?
I didn't see any.
I find the thing is doing exactly what you wanted them to do, namely clarify our own thinking. But and they're stated in absolutist terms. The church bodies ought never hope to lose. No Christian should say this to the Lord. But all of our discussion assumes not every situation, but only a particular one, one in which democratic discourse can in fact function. You're talking about what you want is dialogue, exchange. And so you're making absolute statements, however, for a particular, what you desire is the kind of thing that takes place only in the democratic context.
Yeah, did I forget to say at the beginning that I'm talking about 1978 United States?
No, you didn't.
I should have.
I just think of all kinds of other situations where I think maybe someone may need to if he or she has courage enough to say, thus saith the Lord, and rather absolutist statements, or the church ought to take a stand. You mentioned the confessing church in Germany. That was not a democratic situation where one could appeal to processes of exchange and dialogue in order to form public opinion in a way that allows then individuals and larger groups to take actions to transform society. So the situation may be a significant qualifier of any statements that are stated in the way that you have stated.
Yeah, I really am sorry I didn't say that. I had some more preliminary remarks here, and I meant to say that I'm talking about our situation,
yeah.
And in different. I did say in difference. If the world were different,
yeah.
I might come to different
some
conclusions.
Places the world is different right now.
Right,
yeah.
In some places it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think our situation is the one in which we spend most of our time, so we ought to focus on it.
I don't agree. I just wanted to point out that it assumes
yeah.
a certain context.
Right.
How do you personally work within the system? I mean, with church as an organization, I'm assuming that you belong to a Lutheran church, that you're a member of a Lutheran church. Is that a wrong assumption? You don't want to answer.
I'm not going to answer on the grounds that any answer will tend to incriminate
I don't care whether you belong or not. I'm asking for my benefit. I find it very difficult to work within the structure of the church. I get frustrated constantly.
So do
and
I.
I'm in full agreement with your theses.
So do
I've
I.
I've never heard them stated just the way you have, but I'm in agreement.
Oh, I'm coming. I'm going to come to...
But see, I have to leave Saturday morning.
Yeah, well... You will never know.
No, I really don't care.
I'll tell you.
I guess what I'm asking you is because I think that you are a person who is more in touch with the real world. Is there some other way for the church to function than in the organizational structure we have now?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. My own hope and what I'm working for and the reason that any answer I'd given to your question would have embarrassed me is that last year I was for a long time a member of three churches and none of them was Lutheran. But that was because I was trying to implement the conviction that the church had to be a fellowship of folk who lived around one another.
Mm-hmm.
Because that the church couldn't be anything, couldn't be what it was supposed to be, if it was people who never saw one another from Sunday to Sunday, except for artificial occasions, you know, ladies' aid, and all the, but you just meet it, don't we see one another at the church, that the church ought to be people gathered around the gospel and the sacraments who are also crisscrossing all during the week, and who therefore can bring their real lives into the church on Sunday, who know one another's lives, who don't, for example, when Tom and Jerry are getting a divorce, that's known. That isn't something that, how come Tom hasn't been here?
They're
splitting. Yeah. You just discover that. And now, that's, I am so convinced that that's,
yeah.
that's to me so important for the life of the church. But I can't be terribly interested in alternative ways of improving the church.
The church in my neighborhood happens to be the biggest church in town. And I go there, I hate it. I shouldn't say I hate it, but it's so big and has so many people. I would much rather go to a smaller church. But I too have this conviction, you go to the church nearest you live. And
Do you have a lot of neighbors who are members of that church?
No.
Well,
I don't.
That's the problem. See, that's the problem. It's not the thing is not to go to the church nearest your house. The thing is to go to the church where your neighbors go, or the people with whom you work.
They all go their own separate ways.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. It's pluralist society. That's what the problem is. The people for the dumbest reasons are members. Persistent members of different denominations, you know, and the reasons are just dumb. It's nationality and And within even within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, there is enormous doctrinal difference. Even among the conservatives, there's enormous doctrinal difference. And what for years kept them in united was that they were all German, and most of the pastors were interrelated through marriage. But you know, now that you go, but you transplant that in the suburbs of Bellevue. Golly, you know, there's enough fragmentation out there. Why can't they all go to the same church? But now, I'm not seriously recommending we therefore establish, like they did in Park Forest, Illinois. You know, Park Forest, Illinois was the community about which W.H. White wrote in The Organization Man. And when the builders developed, that was one of the first, you know, that was going to make the suburbs of Eden. And they had a community church. But that was no good, because what was the theology of the community church? Oh, it's whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You can't, darn it, you know, you see people going to different churches for dumb reasons, and yet you say, oh, come on now, let's all go to this church. But how do you, churches can't really be created. All these dumb reasons nourish us, you know that? I sing a line, Gott in der Heiser, and it has all kinds of meaning that it doesn't have for somebody else. I mean, God does come to us through our nationalities and our families and our... it's frustrating.
It is. I seek my spiritual enrichment from a small group that I'm in that meets.
Yeah.
And I still, it's not a church, but I get more spiritual help there than...
Well, that's confirming something. You know, that you, it's very difficult to get spiritual help from people with whom you are not intimate.
Right.
And it's impossible to be intimate with people among whom you do not live and or work. Now, you know what the solution is? It's for people who are members of the same church to all move to the same neighborhood and work in the same shop.
Oh, but that was dumb, too. You had to see him all day? No way.
Oh, wouldn't that be exciting?
Say it again. I'll see how dull it would be.
It's a job!
Not necessarily. I don't think
so. I don't fraternize with anybody I work with because I've seen him all day. And
you know, but you know what I think? I think that's because you don't know them well enough to engage them in conversations of depth. The real, you want to get away from those people down at work because all your conversation with them is superficial, and you don't want to carry that superficial conversation home with you. But the reason your conversation with them at work is superficial is because you don't know them well enough. If you both worked with them and lived around them, you might know them well enough to carry on exciting conversations with them.
But you need superficial conversations to live. Who wants to have exciting conversations all the time?
You can always find a superficial conversation. Just talk to yourself. No.
There's
no,
a lot of superficial conversations right there.
Fine. You know, in fact, two people, Julie and I have superficial conversations, and I know her pretty well. But we do. We just talk flippantly. You can always have a superficial conversation with an intimate friend. But you can't have an intimate conversation with a superficial friend.
I just get concerned. I just told Larry that you are getting so provincial, soon you will not leave the block.
There's so much to be done on my own block.
I know.
I pick up the trash and it's there again the next morning.
Yes, but then my ego gets involved there when I... Because I think, well, I should be out there because I can help. You know, I should be working on the synod level because I can do better than they can do. Now that's an intimate statement that just really popped out. Don't you? Oh boy, don't you get the feeling if you? I mean, she was speaking flippantly.
Yeah.
But actually, every one of us should be happy to do our work of the Lord in our own block. But all of a sudden you get this.
I think so. You know, I think we can do a lot more.
Yeah, we can.
And the closer, I really think the closer we are to home, the more real difference we can make.